then they're going to give up. So it looks good. I got more people to actually sign up and maybe use the product once, but after they tried it, it didn't work well. So what I like to do is take the most passionate customers on the product, really learn what they love about the product, how they use the product, and then build my promise off of the input from those people about what they love about the product. And then when you acquire people on that promise, they're just much more likely to really end up loving and sharing the product and using the product.
Check, check. Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe Social Marketing Nerds. Welcome everyone to our Social Marketing Nerds podcast. My name is Ben Kostner. Thank you very much for tuning in. So we are just a few days ahead of our conference AdsCamp in Cologne. And today we are broadcasting our second English episode. But as this is usually a German podcast, let us give a quick German introduction so everyone from Germany knows what the heck is going on, and then we are going to switch back to English for this episode. Ja, moin moin, hier ist der Ben Küstner von den Social Marketing Nerds. Vielen Dank, dass du wieder eingeschaltet hast. Heute haben wir unsere zweite englische Ausgabe. Und warum ist das Ganze auf Englisch? Wir stehen wenige Tage vor unserem Jahreshöhepunkt, dem AdsCamp in Köln. Unsere Konferenz, wir erwarten an die 600 Teilnehmer und zum ersten Mal haben wir einen Konferenztag, der nur auf Englisch ist. Wir übersetzen da aber nicht einfach die Vorträge auf Englisch, sondern wir fliegen wirklich Leute quer aus Europa und den Vereinigten Staaten ein. Facebook-Experten, Marketing-Experten und Growth-Marketing-Experten. Und über wen rede ich da? Über unseren heutigen Podcast-Gast. Ich bin sehr stolz, dass wir ihn gewinnen konnten. Wir haben heute zu Gast bei uns im Interview einen Pionier des Growth Marketings. Es ist Sean Ellis. Sean Ellis hat mit seinem 2017 veröffentlichten Buch Hacking Growth die Marketingwelt schon ein Stück weit auf den Kopf gestellt. Und ich bin wirklich sehr stolz, dass wir ihn für unsere Konferenz in Köln gewinnen konnten. Er wird eine Keynote auf unserem zweiten englischen Tag halten. Darüber hinaus wird er einen Workshop halten am Folgetag. Das macht er zum ersten Mal tatsächlich in Deutschland und ja, für alle, die eben nicht dabei sein können, beim AdsCamp 2019 haben wir diese Podcast-Folge aufgenommen. So könnt ihr ein bisschen in die Welt von Sean Ellis einsteigen, in die Welt des Growth Marketings. Die Konzepte von Sean Ellis gehen weit eben über das Thema Facebook-Werbung, Pinterest-Werbung und Performance-Marketing hinaus. Es geht um agiles Marketing und ich kenne eigentlich niemanden, der in der Lage ist, die Konzepte holistisch so schnell und gut knackig auf den Punkt zu bringen. Es sind Konzepte, die eigentlich schon seit 10 Jahren in Silicon Valley verwendet werden. Facebook ist mit auch einer der Vorreiter selbst gewesen. Und aber auch in Deutschland, muss man sagen, gibt es ja mittlerweile einige Unternehmen, die sich dieser Konzepte oder ähnlicher Konzepte angeeignet haben. Zum Beispiel Zalando oder About You, finde ich, machen da einen sehr, sehr fortschrittlichen Eindruck. Und bevor ich jetzt eben hier schon zu viel verrate, wünsche ich euch jetzt viel Spaß mit unserem englischen Interview mit the one and only Sean Ellis. Let's go. So, back to English. Yes, thank you for staying on. So once again, we are the Social Marketing Nerds. We started with social advertising, especially performance marketing on Facebook here in Germany around 2012, just when it kicked off here in Germany. And we are actually just a few days ahead of our own conference, which is called AdsCamp 2019. It takes place here in Cologne, Germany, and it's a conference focusing on social advertising and performance marketing, especially on social media channels like Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and so on. And from our experience, from the companies we work with, we have actually learned that in today's world, as competition is getting tougher on all these platforms, today it actually takes a bit more than just to know which buttons to click. It's always good to know where some short-term opportunities are, but to build long-term successful campaigns to make a positive ROI in the long run from Facebook ads and co, it takes a bit more. You have to holistically think about your marketing approach. And our today's guest is actually an expert on this field. He is the author of the famous book, Hacking Growth. He is one of the keynote speakers at our conference this year. So without any further ado, we're gonna play the interview now. I have to apologize for the mic quality. Actually, my mic was a bit too loud. We did all the best to make the sound quality as good as possible. So apologies for the sound quality. Have fun with the interview. All right, listeners. Now we have him on the show, Sean Ellis, the author of Hacking Growth. Welcome to the show, Sean Ellis.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be on.
Yeah, thank you for sharing some time with us. Growth hacking is probably one of the most famous marketing buzzwords of our time and also one of the most misunderstood. And you are actually associated with coming up with the term. And so before we really dive into what it actually is, can you talk a little bit about your background and what has actually led you to become a growth hacker and to writing that book? Yeah,
absolutely. So, I really started in the super early days of the internet on marketing. So I invested all of my money in a company in 1995 and then started working for that company in 1996. So that was uproar. But then, you know, over the next 15 years, I had the opportunity to be the early growth and marketing person on five different companies that reached that unicorn status, that sort of $1 billion plus valuation. And the first two were that first company was called Uproar. It became a top 10 website in the world. It was the number one game site in the world. And then after that, I helped get LogMeIn off the ground, and so LogMeIn is now about a $4 or $5 billion company, depending on where the stock market is on a certain day. But for both of those first two companies, I took them all the way through their IPO filings, so I got to see really from customer zero all the way to having a company that could be listed on NASDAQ. And then what I realized was that a lot of the work that I did on those companies, really the most valuable was kind of the first, you know, in the first year and you know, trying to, like, once we had a product that was ready to go to market, what were all the things that we did to accelerate growth in those businesses? That was when I made the most valuable contribution. So then for the next few years after that, I decided to really try to focus just on that first year or first 6 months even. And so that's when I worked on companies like Dropbox and Eventbrite and Lookout, where it was super early stage, and help take those companies to market. And then really kind of how all of that led to the coining of the growth hackers term was that I realized, yeah, after a while, at first I was, you know, it was kind of the early days, so I was just kind of making it up as I went along. But especially because I started, the first two companies actually started out of Eastern Europe, out of Hungary. And so I didn't have a lot of people around me who were necessarily doing the same thing. So I just kind of made it up as I went along. And I realized kind of within a few years that my approach was pretty different than what I saw most people doing. But then I also looked around and saw that Facebook and LinkedIn and some other companies were taking a more similar approach to what I was doing and less of a traditional marketing approach. So that was really what led me to want to come up with kind of redefining how you grow companies, kind of beyond marketing. And that's where this term growth hacking came from, largely because I was trying to hire in people to these companies to replace me after I got them off the ground. And I wanted people who would approach growth in a way that I thought would be effective. And so by giving it a different name, I could really define what the role was and find people who would raise their hand and say, yeah, that's me. That's how I approach it.
So now the term is used, is almost like a household name among marketing departments. But I think the definition of it can be quite differently interpreted.
Right.
So what is your definition of growth hacking?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the reason why we wrote the book, was because there was so much confusion around the term, and we really wanted to have a book that outlined what it was. But I think in the most basic sense, obviously there's enough that I could fill an entire book with it, but in just a couple of sentences, it's really about thinking holistically about growth and not just simply the acquisition channels, but realizing that there's a lot of different levers to growth. And if you apply data across each of those levers, really across a customer journey, and then you experiment to try to drive improvement across each of those levers, you can really drive much more substantial growth than if you're simply focused on what a lot of marketers do, which would be maybe advertising and early funnel conversion. But if you take it all the way through, that's where a lot of power comes from. And so it extends beyond marketing to really product teams, engineering teams, and ideally the whole company starts to think about growth and how they impact growth.
Okay. So, when we met in Oslo, you talked about your story at LogMeIn. You were the first marketer there. And so most of our listeners are marketers. And most of them struggle with limited budgets, limited access to landing pages, limited impact on the product. But I think your process of growing companies really has helped growing LogMeIn. So can you talk a little bit on your experience at LogMeIn?
Sure.
How did that take place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's kind of interesting, if you think about it, really every business, even giant business, have some kind of limitation on their marketing budgets. And, you know, if you can prove that if I invest a dollar, I'm going to get more than a dollar back, or maybe in the case of Germany, I invest a euro, I'm going to get more than a euro back, then it's usually possible to get your hands on more money. So the real challenge in my experience is that profitable ROI, the profitable return on investment on spending the money. And that's where the real challenge comes in, is if you're simply focused on buying the ads and maybe optimizing the ads and testing different media, it's really hard to drive that profitable ROI. But when you start to think, okay, how do I get someone not just clicking on an ad, but actually experiencing the product and building a habit around using the product, then you're much more likely to be able to drive that ROI and scale customer acquisition. So a lot of that learning came at LogMeIn when it was kind of mid-2000s. I did what most marketers do. I said, okay, I'm hired as the VP of marketing. I'm going to go out and start trying to acquire customers. And so I did lots of testing across the channels, lots of different ad testing and other things. And I found that I could spend about $10,000 a month. And every time I tried to expand beyond that, I just couldn't find new opportunities for profitable expansion. But when we stepped back and looked at the data, it was clear that more than 90% of the people who were signing up for LogMeIn never used the product, not even once. And so if they don't even try the product, so they just fill out a registration form, we're not going to get a return on investment on those people. And so, but the problem was that a lot of the part where they were falling off really fell outside of the marketing team's responsibility or even, you know, permission to experiment in that area. So that's where I talked to the CEO, I presented the data to him, hoping maybe I'd get one product person to work with me, but I was surprised by his reaction, which was, oh, we need to get this fixed, so the entire company needs to make this the priority and the focus. So he put a freeze on all product development and basically said, for the foreseeable future, we're going to focus on how do we get, particularly this new user activation, how do we get a new user who signs up to actually use the product. And so through months of experimentation and, you know, many, many experiments, we were actually able to increase the sign up to usage rate by about 1,000%. And so when we did that, suddenly we were just much more efficient. So that just meant like every dollar we were spending, we got 10 times the return on investment that we got before that. And so suddenly lots of channels that weren't effective now were really profitable for us. And it actually, so no new creativity was really needed. It just, we had the efficiency. So when I went out and tested everything again, I could now spend over $1 million a month on customer acquisition with a really fast payback on those marketing dollars spent. And those people who use the product and love the product told their friends. And it's really the whole engine unlocked from there. But that was to me a big aha moment that what I could do as a marketer really wasn't going to drive the growth that we wanted nearly as much as if we got everyone in the company thinking about growth and how to get more customers getting a good experience with the product.
So it was breaking up the silos within the company and focusing with all team efforts on actually bringing value to the customers. That was really what has led to record success there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think value is really the thing that's critical that you're hitting on there, that someone who just fills out a form gets no value. But if they actually come in and experience the product, and you've built a product that delivers really good value and something that's valuable that they want to come back and keep using, then growth is possible. Then if you can't retain users with a good experience, then growth is almost impossible, because really what you're doing is you're replacing every month the last set of users that you brought in that all disappeared. And so, yeah, and then getting that to happen is just goes so much beyond what most marketing departments can do on their own. It's really, that's what the entire company is for, is creating that engine for building value and introducing customers to that value.
So in this context, you all often talk about the concept of a North Star metric. Can you dive into that a little bit? How does this help in the process?
Yeah, so that's, and I really learned this from we kind of executed on the concept of North Star metric at LogMeIn. Like I said, it was something that we knew if someone didn't use the product, they weren't getting any value. But this idea of a North Star metric was something I learned from Facebook, and it's essentially trying to understand how people get value from the product and then quantifying that value across a growing customer base. So you're focused on growing the metric that really matters about knowing that you're delivering more and more value. So yeah, the best way to kind of understand this is a little bit confusing, but the best way to understand it is just with a couple examples. So for Facebook, If you looked at Facebook and you said, okay, our main goal is to get as many profiles in the system as possible, then if you think about it, you could have billions of profiles that are never seen by anybody because somebody set it up and then they just disappeared and they're not public anyway, and so no one could access it. So what they realized is that it's really through the people that are coming back on a daily basis that you get value on Facebook. And so they looked at daily active users instead of profiles. So that's kind of makes sense. A lot of companies have been looking at daily active users for a while. Uber is a little, I think, more interesting. So I actually interviewed the first head of growth at Uber at the Growth Hackers Conference a couple of years ago. And one of the things that he said is the very first thing that he did when he left Facebook to join Uber was sit down with the CEO and say, we have to define our North Star metric. And so they looked at things like, should we look at app downloads or how many new drivers we bring into the system? But what they realized that the value with Uber was when someone really takes a ride. So if any time that there's a ride that's delivered with Uber, money is given to a driver, and then, you know, a rider actually gets to their destination. And so that's the valuable thing. So what they measure at Uber is weekly rides. And every week that they have growth in those weekly rides, they know they're creating more value and they're creating a more valuable asset.
So that I really like your concept. And here, I think the point is really important to the misconception of growth hacking is that most people understand it as getting cheap clicks to your website or even free clicks by kind of hacking into some system of like Google or Facebook. I think that's what most people understand when they hear growth hacking, but it's actually not about those vanity metrics like cheap clicks or app downloads. It's about finding out what is the value of our product, and are we delivering more value to more people every week or every month?
Right.
And that should be the more important company goal than just generating free clicks or whatever.
Absolutely. And it's not to say that free clicks can't be valuable or that downloads can't be valuable, but it's important to recognize that those metrics by themselves don't create value. It's you have to understand how do more visitors lead to more growth of that North Star metric or more value delivered to customers. And when you can start to connect the dots on these different ways of growing your North Star metric, that's when it gets pretty exciting.
But the North Star metric at the end of the day is then the goal of the North Star metric is to share a mission among the whole company and not having the marketing team focusing on clicks and the product team focusing on some other metrics. So to unify and to have everyone work on the same towards the same mission.
Absolutely, and that's what's. But from the marketer's perspective, what's really exciting is when you have a product team that's not just thinking about how do I build that next great feature, but how do I help new users experience the product in the right way? What are the features that I can do that help to build a habit? When you start having all of the teams working together to grow that North Star metric, suddenly the marketing job becomes a lot easier because now when I'm acquiring a user, they're going into a really efficient system to turn them into a valuable, loyal customer.
Yeah. And so as most of our listeners are marketers, let's still focus a little bit on the first part of the whole customer journey. So on user acquisition. So how do you approach it? And what do you think about paid advertising?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily about budgets. So while some people are pretty anti-paid advertising, I'm fine with paid advertising as long as you have a positive return on investment. So I think the challenge happens is that paid advertising has become so much more competitive that a lot of people have a hard time getting that return on investment. And then one other thing with paid advertising is that what I did find, so we were pretty dependent on paid advertising at LogMeIn, like spending millions of dollars a month by the end. And it's really hard to keep growing at the same rate when you're growing via paid advertising, because if I want to add another 10,000 people a day, it's really hard to find some new way to add another 10,000 people a day on top of what's already working, especially because channels are declining over time. So when I started working on Dropbox, I had that lesson in mind where I thought, you know, there's so much passion from this user base that's already on the product, and there's a lot of kind of natural word of mouth, but there's also, you know, some collaboration features and some sharing features and some other things in the product that if we can try to build our growth engine off of our existing user base, then really the more users we have, the bigger our growth engine becomes to get even more users. And so that approach actually helped Dropbox become the fastest SaaS business to ever reach the $1 billion revenue run rate. And I think a lot of it was just because we stayed at a really good growth trajectory when most companies that are relying on paid advertising over time start to flatten out just because you can't feed that growth trajectory with paid channels at the same rate.
So I think when starting a company, I think paid advertising is very advantageous to get traction very quickly.
Yeah.
And to be able to test very quickly with your first potential customers. But then, as you said, in order to really grow the company, you with time, you have to find out why are people signing up and why are other people not signing up, and finding out really what is the value of the product, and then become independent of paid advertising. So in the beginning, I think Facebook advertising, search advertising on Google or other channels are really powerful to get fast traction. But then to really grow the business, you have to become undependent of those channels, because you can't do a hockey stick like Dropbox did.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean one of the interesting challenges that I found as well, though, is that I completely agree that actually paid advertising is kind of easier when you're smaller, because you don't need to find many things that work to be able to get that traction. But what I do find is that the longer that you rely on paid advertising, the less likely that you are to become really creative about free effective ways to grow the business. So it's kind of you become kind of addicted to the paid advertising, and you get so busy managing it that it's sometimes hard to break out of that cycle. But I think for most of us, traction is the hardest part anyway. So I wouldn't worry too much. It's just like a minor caveat that sort of says, you know, carve out enough time to try to be creative about free channels as well, because a lot of times there's a lot more scale in the free channels.
So, and the concept is of testing and experimenting along the whole customer journey is, I think, key to your growth hacking concept. And in paid advertising, testing is the most important growth driver anyways, but now we really learned that it's basically important to grow the whole company. Talking about testing and experimenting, I really like your analogy from the book, the analogy to the game of battleships. So can you talk a little bit about the different concept of experimentation you experienced?
Yeah, sure. I want to make sure I give credit where credit's due on this. I actually first heard Brian Balfour, someone who's well known in growth circles, use this analogy. I just liked it so much that I borrow it quite a bit. But the idea is that, like in the game of Battleship, when you're guessing where your opponent's ships are, you don't get to see where their ships are. You're just kind of guessing the coordinates. Every guess you make, you're actually learning something. You're learning either there was a ship there or there wasn't a ship there. And over time, you're kind of spreading those pegs around a board. And when you hit something, then you're going to want to drop a lot of pegs right in that area. And I think what that analogy carries over into growth and marketing is that, you know, a lot of people look at, I failed too many times, I'm a bad marketer. But it's you're not failing. You're test, 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 win. And that you have to basically run the tests to find the things that are going to work. And if you don't run the tests and you're disappointed when a test doesn't work, you're probably not actually testing. You're just doing something. And so by having lots of tests, you get smarter and smarter about what's going to work to grow a business. And you obviously want to be smart about how you're doing that testing and be strategic about it. But at the end of the day, if you're not running lots of tests, you're very unlikely to learn effective ways for growing the business.
So from failure, you can also learn a lot. You on stage in Oslo, you talked about your other experience with Kuala Roo,
yeah,
where you basically totally failed it, but at the end of the day, have learned something totally unexpected.
Right. Yeah, in that example, I had mentioned that I convinced investors to let me buy a company based on an experiment that I was sure was going to work. I was very confident. I mean, you're never 100% sure, but I was very confident. But I also did control their expectations and say, hey, if this doesn't work, here's what will happen and here's what we'll do based on this. So it may not work, but here's the risk, here's the reward. And so our idea was we would buy this company and then make the free version of this product way better than it had been. They had a kind of light, not very good free version. And so we did it. We not only spent the money, but we spent the time building out the better free version, and we put it out there. And we learned that that there was almost no increase in demand when we made the free version really good, but there was definitely a decrease in demand for the paid version. And so we had a pretty good drop off on our MRR growth, our monthly recurring revenue growth. And so we could have considered that a disaster, but yeah, we stepped back and said, what did we learn from this? We learned there's not very much price sensitivity around this product. If people know they need it, they're willing to pay quite a bit for it. If they don't know they need it, then having a free version doesn't really help very much. And so we actually turned off the free version and over time increased the price significantly on the paid version and grew many times over at a very good rate, but in a very different model. So even that first test was led to the breakthrough discovery of what drove a lot of that growth.
Okay. And we talked about LogMeIn before already. So in the case of LogMeIn, the activation or onboarding part, so onboarding the acquired users was the bigger level of growth. Is that rather usual or unusual to your experience?
Yeah, in my experience, that's almost every company underinvests in new user activation. So as I touched on before, the product team is usually focused on they feel like they're one feature away from making it so you don't even need marketers on the team anymore, that the product's going to be so good that it's just going to explode in growth. And marketing teams are usually very, you know, advertising, externally focused, and maybe they're testing landing pages, which is pretty smart, but then they rarely have the ability to change what an installer on software looks like, or what are the first features you see when you start using a product. Like, that kind of stuff is outside the skill set of most marketing teams, and outside of where they would have permission even if they did have the skills. And so it gets left undone. But the fastest growing companies, especially in the consumer space, are often spending 50% of their product development resources on that first user experience and just testing and testing and testing. And when you get a new user to use the product in the right way, it's just so much easier to convert and retain those users, get that return on investment on all those dollars that you're spending or the effort that you're spending to acquire them, and then ultimately get a lot more people having a great experience with the product.
So that does mean, on the one hand, getting the people who came to your website to actually converting, and or even go further to actually do what you want them to do. And here, different value propositions can work. And also, I liked your explanations around the whole thing about value propositions, and that it's also important for later retention. What value proposition, with what promise, do you actually get the users in?
Exactly.
That has a lot of impact on the whole growth of the company at the end of the day.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I've definitely learned over time, is that it's not always about getting the highest response rate top of funnel, because if you lead with a false promise around what the product's going to do for people and it doesn't effectively do that, then they're going to give up. So it looks good. I got more people to actually sign up and maybe use the product once, but after they tried it, it didn't work well. So what I like to do is take the most passionate customers on the product, really learn what they love about the product, how they use the product, and then build my promise off of the input from those people about what they love about the product. And then when you acquire people on that promise, they're just much more likely to really end up loving and sharing the product and keeping using the product.
And that's really the thing I like, because really understanding why do people sign up or why do people use this on a daily basis, if you have that information, you can use it up front again to acquire new users, and that will probably work better on the front end, acquiring them more cheaply and retaining them for a long period of time.
Yeah, and I think that, and again, I think the counterintuitive point there is that sometimes that means a slightly lower conversion rate top of funnel, but you know, there's kind of an old joke that you know, if you just say your product is pornography or gambling, you're going to get a lot more people. Yeah. Using it, but not all products are going to do that. You're getting a lot more people signing up for it, but so maybe I'm going to have less people when they find out that it's kind of a boring value proposition, but the people I get are going to be people who need that value and are going to keep using that value. So it's really about building an authentic growth engine around what the product is truly great at doing.
Yeah. Okay, so in Silicon Valley, actually, most of the famous companies have a growth team, and they are using these principles. Facebook, we already talked about a little about them. Facebook was one of the first teams really making use of the concept. So can you dive a bit deeper more about their Northstar metric and how they approach the whole thing?
Absolutely. So I think, yeah, Facebook's really a pioneer. If you want to learn more about this stuff, besides going to the conference in May and ideally attending the workshop and reading the book, just study Facebook a lot, because they do a lot of things right. So I think that the North Star metric and then the growth team was really something that, what I learned, as I mentioned, that most of the companies I worked on, I left by the time they were filing for an IPO, where Facebook has really figured out how do you scale these things to where you can have a billion users or 2 billion users. And a lot of what they've done is they've built these cross-functional growth teams that they have all the skills embodied in a single team, where they can focus just on growing one particular part of the business, but they can move really fast with that experimentation. I think what's critical, though, even if they're just focused on one part of the business, they understand the North Star metric. Those people do. And everyone else in the business also understands the North Star metric. And the overall purpose of what they're doing is to grow that North Star metric. And so that's another thing that's interesting with Facebook, is that every single person in the company from their browser can type in, they actually call it daily active people, is their kind of internal lingo for daily active users. So they can just type in DAP into their browser and they'll see what the latest trend line is on where they are in their daily active people number. But the other thing that I think is really interesting here on how they use that, so they discovered, so again, if activation is the critical piece, how does a new person on Facebook, the first day you sign up on Facebook, how do I start getting value? It's not like Dropbox where I can kind of like, oh, I've saved my files, now I feel like they're there, or I've actually got them on two of my computers. But with Dropbox or with Facebook, you actually need to get value with the product. You need to connect with other people. And so you create your profile, and then with one connection, you're probably not going to come back the next day. Or if you came back, that person is unlikely to make an update. But they realize by studying the data that it's really not until you have about seven connections that you have enough new information in your feed on Facebook that you would come back every day. And if it takes you 6 months to get those seven friends, most people, that's too long of a wait until I get some value. So most people will give up on Facebook. So that's the other thing they learned from the data, is that if they can get those seven friends in about 10 days or less, then they're likely to convert and retain those people. So that just changes everything they do in the business. So what they're doing in the beginning is really experimenting around, how do I get people to find people they know and connect before they give up on the service? So instead of showing a lot of advertisements, they'll show, here's some people you might know. Once you connect with a couple people, then they can introduce even more people that you might know. And so it's all about trying to get you to that tipping point so that you ultimately become that long-term user on Facebook.
And I think another recent example here in Germany is Netflix. So in Germany here, there was actually a big competitor. It was run by a big television company, and they started online streaming like 3 or 4 years before Netflix started here in Germany. And they actually never really pulled it off. So they were pushed hard by the television company, meaning they were on advertisements for years and they got a lot of traffic, obviously, but nobody really used the product. Nobody really found value in online streaming the way they did it. Well, and then two years ago, approximately, Netflix kicked off here in Germany, and it spread like wildfire. Now we have like probably every second German has a Netflix account. And they're also really heavily focusing on growth.
Yeah, I mean, I think Netflix is a really interesting case, really, really in the United States as well, where you have these 100-year-old companies that own all of this amazing content that have had a really hard time competing with Netflix. So even Disney and 21st Century Fox recently merging to be able to compete with Netflix is just crazy when you think about how new Netflix is relative to those businesses. But I think the difference is Netflix was really born from the ground up around data. So, you know, it started as a subscription DVD business. And so like churn reduction was really important for them. They did a lot of experimentation around recommendations to figure out, how do I get someone using the product so that they don't cancel their subscription? And then with streaming, they had more data to work from. And they've built this culture of data and experimentation and growth that these older companies, it's really hard for them to break out of silos and rethink how they approach growth. And so all they want to do is throw a whole bunch of money on the customer acquisition side, but that's just not enough to make the whole system work when you're competing against a company like Netflix that has this fully integrated engine all the way through to creating passionate, loyal customers. And so I think you're going to see this a lot across a lot of other industries. And you touched on early in our conversation that a lot of these companies don't have big budgets to market with. But I think that the advantage that they have generally of their early startup companies or earlier smaller companies is that they don't have decades of habits around being in silos, and that, that they can build their organization right from the beginning and have that North Star metric, and everyone in the company can operate together to grow that North Star metric. And it'll be interesting over the next few years. I think we're going to see a lot of other sectors, like what Netflix has done in the entertainment space or Amazon has done in the retail space. I think we're going to see that across a lot of other business sectors. That's going to cause a lot of established companies to either have a crisis-led change in how they operate, or they're going to really start to shrink.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time and for your insights here. So, on May the 14th and on the 15th, we're going to meet at our conference. So you're going to do the keynote presentation on the 14th of May. And then on the 15th of May, we're going to go a one-day deep dive workshop around growth hacking. So can you share a little bit of what you're going to talk about on stage and in the workshop?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're going to really just expand on a lot of what you and I have talked about today and just help the audience understand how to operate in this way where, you know, ultimately, you know, I know a lot of the attendees are going to be marketers, and you can't always drive kind of full company change as a marketer. But if you understand what your dependencies are, and I'll give you some strategies and how you get your CEO involved to be able to ideally organize the business in a way that's going to make your job a lot easier. So, I mean, that's one tip that I would give you, is that if you can get your head of product, your CEO, and some others actually attending the workshop, your life is going to be much easier in terms of how you can be effective growing your company. Again, I started as a marketer, and you know, being able to see, I was banging my head against the wall, having such a hard time growing LogMeIn. And then once the CEO and the rest of the organization got behind, particularly customer activation, I was way more effective as a marketer on the customer acquisition side. But it was, we all knew our role in growing that North Star metric. So I'll give you that perspective in the keynote and give you some tools, but it's really in the workshop where we can go deep. And if you can bring some other kind of core department heads in your business, then you can really go to drive the changes in your company that are going to help you really dominate in your sector.
Awesome. So yeah, we are really looking forward to meet you here in Cologne, and we're going to have some beers on top of that. So yeah, until then, where can our listeners contact and find more about you?
My recommendation is probably if you want to get directly in touch with me, LinkedIn's a good way to do it. And just, you know, in the invitation, just mention this podcast. But we have lots of content on growthhackers.com too, if you want to go through that. And a lot of times if you post questions there, I'm jumping in to answer those questions. But I'm definitely looking forward to meeting a lot of you in Germany in May.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. Right. And talk to you soon.
Perfect. Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for listening all the way through. I hope you found great value in this podcast, actually. And if that is the case, we would be delighted if you could rate us on iTunes, rate this podcast, Social Marketing Nerds. And yes, I can highly recommend Sean's book if you can't make it to our conference. Next year, the conference is going to take place again on our website, adscamp.com. That is adscamp.com. You can subscribe to our newsletter, and then you're going to get an email as soon as we announce our next year's conference. But for now, this is it. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great time.